listening to Beyond the Jargon, a jargon-free look at graduate students and their research journeys here at the University of Victoria. Beyond the Jargon, I'm your host today, Liz MacArthur. Joining me in the studio is Neil Valance, who's completing his PhD in law here at the University of Victoria. Thank you for joining me today.
You're very welcome.
PhD in law could mean a lot of things. What does it mean for you? What is the focus of your degree?
They have a program, Law and Society, so that it's not black letter law. I'm not learning the finer points of evidence or criminal law. Mm-hmm. I'm studying legal history, specifically colonial legal history. And my area of interest is to do with historical treaties between First Nations and the Crown, especially the local treaties made with First Nations and a guy called James Douglas back in the 1850s.
Why are you particularly drawn to this? How did you start researching this?
Well, I had the opportunity to get some work for specific claims branch of Indian Affairs back in 1999. And one of the first tasks I was assigned was a claim by the Nanaimo Band of Indians, or the Sinemuk First Nation. They had made a claim to Indian Affairs for compensation for the breach of some rights they claimed under their Douglas Treaty. And I was given the task of doing the historical research on that claim. And that's where I first came across the Douglas Treaties. I must confess, in spite of being a native Victorian, I had never heard of them until that point.
Hmm. So you've worked as a lawyer previous to doing your PhD here. Can you give us an idea of some of your experience before you started this degree?
Sure. I mean, my connection with U of X starts 49 years ago. I was a Frosh in 1965.
Wow.
And I ended up getting a BA in anthropology in 1969. Sadly, I lost my way and ended up at law school because my mother wanted me to be a lawyer, I think. And so that I went to UBC Law School. There was no U of X Law School at the time. Hmm. Got a law degree, didn't really intend to practice law, but a friend talked me into it. And we hung out our shingle in 1976 out in Colwood, a firm called Dinning & Valance, still going all these years later. It's now called Dinning Hunter. Mm-hmm. But so I practiced law out there as a suburban solicitor, doing the normal things for families, their wills, house purchases, mortgages, handling the estates, doing a bit of commercial work and land development work, all pretty ordinary stuff. The one thing I didn't do is I didn't go to court, mm-hmm. and nor did I have anything to do with the area of Aboriginal law. So that, but I brought up a family. Never really felt totally at home as a lawyer. And by 1998, I was looking for other challenges, and I decided that I needed to go see if I can get into grad school and do a master's in anthropology. And I applied, and after a year of undergrad courses to make sure I had enough gray cells to do it, I was admitted into the master's program here at U of X, and had a great time. Mm-hmm. And it was during that time that I started doing the contract work, doing ethnohistorical research on First Nations land claims. Mm-hmm. Started out just working with the specific claims branch, but later on working for First Nations and their lawyers, doing the research and putting out the reports so that hopefully the parties could come to some negotiated settlement of the claim. Mm. So that I must confess I continued to practice law part-time after graduating with my master's in anthropology. I still needed to earn a living. Mm-hmm. So I split my time between doing these research contracts and practicing law, and then got tired of that and decided I needed a fresh challenge. So I retired from practicing law for the second time in 2010, and I'd been so intrigued with the Douglas Treaties during my years of researching claims that I decided that maybe I should become the expert, and was fortunate enough to be admitted to the program. Actually, the sort of reigning expert on the subject is a prof there called Hamar Foster, absolutely the best person possible to be my supervisor. And then I have a co-supervisor outside of law in history, Dr. John Lutz, who's also very knowledgeable. So I kind of have a dream team, and it's been great fun.
Yeah, that's interesting that you have an outside supervisor who is in history. Why are you specifically in the law department studying the history of this rather than in the history department? Is it based on your previous experience as a lawyer, or is it to do specifically with what you're researching?
I think that it's legal history is quite different from straight up history, mm-hmm. In that it's partly to do with the history of law. And so that it requires, I think, a knowledge of the law that is not present in the kind of training you get within a history department. I'm not a trained historian, though, so that's, I think, why I have a historian mm-hmm. to help me with the historiography aspect of things. So that it's the whole Law and Society program is intended to be interdisciplinary, and that's why you always have to have an outside supervisor. And mine has a deeply historical bent to it, so it was appropriate for John to be that person.
Hmm. Let's talk a bit about what you're looking at with the Douglas Treaties. They are something that has, I think, caused confusion with when it comes to present-day land disputes and things like that. Mm-hmm. With them specifically, are you looking at the wording of the documents? Are you looking at like long-term implications to the present day? How are you approaching this, and what are you studying?
The starting point traditionally has been the written documents. There's 14 of them, basically one page each, virtually identical, and they are interesting, but that's not the focus of my research. In fact, I'm sort of problematizing the written versions, pointing out all sorts of difficulties that they don't necessarily represent the agreement of the parties at the time. So that one of the epiphanies I've had was realizing that there are accounts in the archival record of First Nations participants attempting to explain to white audiences their understanding of what was agreed at those meetings. Mm. I think what I'm doing that's unique is taking them seriously and proposing them as an equal alternate narrative as to what happened at the treaty meetings. And if you start, as I do, from the First Nations perspective, you end up at a very different understanding of what the treaties are all about.
Mm-hmm. The First Nations accounts of what happened surrounding the treaties, are they were they oral accounts that were then written down by someone? And how do you find them, or where are they recorded, basically?
Well, they're interesting. There's four accounts given by three people, and they are one of them. The oldest one was a testimony given by a Nanaimo elder by the name of Dick Wolcom. He was able to tell his story in 1913 when something called the Royal Commission on Indian Affairs toured around the province asking First Nations people about their reserves and whether there was enough land or whether there was too much land and they could be made even smaller. Hmm. And so that certainly the commissioners did not want the band members to talk about treaties. They were to talk about other things, but Dick Wolcom was having none of that. He basically brought them up, and a very interesting conversation took place where he basically said that, yes, they entered into a treaty with James Douglas, but that they did not agree to sell their land. that the nature of the agreement was to regularize the arrangements that were already in existence for a coal mine that the Hudson's Bay Company was operating there to, you know, establish royalties. That was his understanding of what happened. So that record is sitting around and in the archival record. It's known, but nobody's really taken it off and dusted it off and analyzed it. So, and then the other one to do with Nanaimo are an elderly couple, Joe and Jenny Wise, who gave an interview to a journalist, Burl Cryer, in 1934, and an article appeared in the Daily Colonist. And she was interviewing them about their recollections of early days. And Dick Woakum was the son of the chief who was representing his people at the meeting with James Douglas in 1854. Joe was maybe 12 or 13 at the time, but remembers well what went on. And so his version, again, is that it was more of a financial transaction, you know, an agreement to share the land and the resources, but not to give them over for a few blankets.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last one was another interview. A journalist for the Daily Colonist interviewed a man by the name of Chief David Latasse from the Tsawit Reserve out on Saanich Peninsula, and a very interesting newspaper article containing his very sophisticated understanding of what was transacted for the Saanich treaties, again saying that you know, his recollection was that a mutual understanding was arrived at to work together to allocate land and to make arrangements for the Europeans to have what they needed for farming, but also to make sure that the wants of the First Nation was taken care of.
Hmm.
So that's what they are. There's also David Latasse has an account of the earliest of the treaties in 1850 with the Songhees in, you know, Greater Victoria area, and that's very interesting as well. There's some problems of accuracy, but then in 1934, David Latasse claimed to be 106 years old, so that whether he really has memories as a young adult or whether I think more likely he was, again, around 11 or 12 at the time and was with his father during the negotiations. But for me, the important thing is the amazing insight he shows into the arrangements that he understood to be made and how it was going to work.
Mm-hmm. And then just so that we can contrast this to the understanding, I guess maybe a mainstream understanding of the Douglas Treaties, mm-hmm. is that the First Nations were given a document from James Douglas and asked to sign, and then that was understood as selling their land. Is that right?
In the normal course of treaties with Indigenous peoples, that's correct. Things were a little backwards in Victoria in that there was no document in existence. They weren't presented with anything. A meeting took place. A list was made of the names of the participants, and X's were put beside their name by a Hudson's Bay clerk.
Mm-hmm.
And then the text was added later. Douglas, after arranging this first set of meetings in 1850, wrote to his superiors in the Hudson's Bay Company to say that, you know, I've had this meeting, but can you please send me a form that I can use and attach it to the signatures? And the form that was sent out from London basically says that the tribe is ceding, surrendering, and giving up any claim it might have to the land described, and there was a very rough description of the territory covered, and that the First Nations were to have their village sites and enclosed fields, whatever that meant, retained for their use, and that they would have the liberty to continue their fisheries as formerly and to hunt over the unoccupied land.
Hmm.
So that it was basically a surrender of any interest in the land plus a promise by the Hudson's Bay Company that was acting as agent for the Crown at this point, that certain activities would be protected for a while, at any rate. Hmm. So that was these documents then were taken to be the treaties for a long time, and it's only recently that their accuracy has been questioned, and especially since the document was supplied months after the meetings and was never shown, to my knowledge, to the First Nation participants.
How many Douglas treaties are there, and do they cover the entire province or just Vancouver Island and then parts of the province?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. They at the time, there was no colony of British Columbia. So it was still part of the Oregon Territory. And Vancouver Island had been set up as a separate colony in 1849 by the British to make sure that the Americans didn't percolate north of the 49th parallel, which had just been established as the boundary. So that they subcontracted that work to the Hudson's Bay Company, which already had some presence on the island, so that the when one of his first jobs, Mr. Douglas, was to enter into agreements to clear away any interest in the land that the First Nations might have in order to open that land up for settlement, because that was the key goal, was to get some settlers on the ground to establish sovereignty and so on and so forth. So that the treaties really only cover Greater Victoria, so that's the city of Victoria, and the Esquimalt, and Souk, and Saanich Peninsula, Beecher Bay, in sort of that area there, and then up at Nanaimo, so that the land in between, that's Cowichan and Chemainus, is not covered by a treaty.
Hmm.
They wanted to negotiate one, but it never quite happened. So there was the one up in Nanaimo, which was entered into because of the coal mine. They wanted to make sure that is to say the colonial types wanted to make sure they got the mineral rights.
Hmm.
And then there was one more up, what was called Fort Rupert, which is Port Hardy. These days, they entered into that one because there was some coal mining there, and they wanted to make sure that they got the mineral rights away from the First Nations.
Hmm.
So that's the extent of it. It's only about 3 or 4% of the area of the island, and there's none of them, no treaties were ever entered into on the colony of British Columbia when it was established in 1858. Douglas and the colonial government decided between them that there was no need for any more treaties, and they just stopped.
But continued to settle.
Oh, indeed. They felt they had the legal authority to place First Nations onto reserves without the necessity of the nuisance of entering into any kind of formal agreements with them. They realized they could get away with it.
Wow. How does this differ from the rest of Canada in the way that treaties and land is handled, basically? Because I've had friends that have moved to British Columbia and been quite surprised by the way that what the current situation is, mm-hmm. because of this this history.
Yeah, the Douglas treaties don't really fit in the narrative of Canadian treaties with Indigenous people, and as a result, the Douglas treaties have been largely ignored because no one knows quite what to do with them.
Mm.
So that the standard narrative begins in the Maritimes in the 18th century with the sort of New France and the American colonies before independence. There were some what they call peace and goodwill treaties entered into with the Indigenous people in Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, the Mi'kmaq, or Mi'kmaq. Those were the earliest ones. They weren't, on the face of it, to do with ceding land. They were about making arrangements to not harm each other and to encourage trade.
Hmm.
Although it turns out, I think there was an undercurrent of a struggle for land going on, but it didn't find its way into the treaties. Then there were a bunch of treaties in Ontario in the late 18th century after the American War of Independence, sort of partly opening up land for the loyalists and so forth, and also rewarding some of the First Nations for their participation in the battles. And so those treaties were, some of them were making a peaceful coexistence arrangements. Some of them did allocate land, set aside some of their territory for settlement, but there were lots of land left over for the First Nations. And so those treaties carpeted Ontario, most of Ontario. And then after Confederation, at this time, the Hudson's Bay Company still owned the rest of what is known as Canada. It was then called Rupert's Land. Mm. And so that the colonial government wanted to make that land available to be added to the newly formed Canada. And the Hudson's Bay Company had undergone a change and was less interested in fur trading than in making money from the land. So the Hudson's Bay Company arranged to sell all of that land to the Canadian government, which then meant it was available for settlement. But but first they had to enter into what are called the numbered treaties across Western Ontario, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta, and then up into some of the Northwest Territories. And those are the best known treaties. They cover vast tracts of land, and there's been dispute about the actual terms of them from when they were formed in the 1870s and until now, as to whether the First Nations actually surrendered all their interest in the land or not, and what the scope of their hunting and fishing rights were within that territory. So that's the sort of flow of time from east to west. But the Douglas Treaties kind of happened in the middle on their own as a kind of outliers on the Pacific, and they didn't involve the colonial government or the Canadian government. They were basically delegated to the Hudson's Bay Company as agent to do, so that they're kind of orphans, and it's therefore one of my tasks is to try and fit them into a bigger picture. In order to do that, I've needed to kind of develop a different structure that where they do fit as opposed to where they don't. And one of my goals is to kind of recategorize the Canadian treaties instead of just peace and goodwill, trade and cession of land. That's extremely colonial, a way of describing them. So having looked at the First Nation understandings through the archival records, I'm hoping to come up with a better terminology that is more useful in terms of understanding what might have actually been the nature of those arrangements.
Mm-hmm. So you want to recategorize and talk about a new language when talking about these treaties. Are there larger implications, you think, about this kind of research? And I mean, this actually affects people's, you know, lives and what's going on politically and socially today. Are you thinking about possible outcomes from what you're studying here?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and they're potentially huge. I mean, I'm not alone in this. There have been plenty of people questioning the basis of the numbered treaties for quite some time. So I'm really following in their footsteps and using the approach developed for those treaties in looking with fresh eyes at the Douglas treaties, and it works very well. And so that I'm not denying, you know, that there are treaties, but just sort of saying that there is an alternate counter-narrative of what went on, which has been largely ignored, and that there's a whole history of legal cases mounted by First Nations to try and sort out what their rights under these treaties are. And they have, to a large extent, the decisions have been based on the official record, the written documents and the official correspondence surrounding them. Some of the cases, the plaintiff First Nations have attempted to prove their claims by the use of oral histories and oral traditions. And that has not been very successful because our court system, one of its fundamental principles is rules of evidence and what counts as evidence and what should receive weight as evidence and what shouldn't. And it's almost impossible for our court system to give full weight to oral traditions. They just don't fit within the rules of evidence. So that's really not worked out well. So my little idea is to seek out the First Nations statements that are in the archival record that are hopefully contemporaneous reports in newspapers and the prairies and so forth. There were journalists who were writing things down and transcribing some of the speeches of the First Nation participants. Mm. First Nations people have long memories, and some of them had long lives, and they lived long enough that their stories of what went on were of interest enough to be newspaper accounts. So these are much later, but at least they are first-person accounts, so that they don't fall into the problem of being hearsay. They're actually eyewitness accounts, so they're good evidence. There just aren't many of them, and they're quite fragmentary. But then one of the things I've been able to show is how partial and fragmentary and problematic the official accounts are. So they really don't, in my mind, have a great deal of superiority, if any, over these First Nation accounts. So that if you choose the stories, draw them from the archives, from these interviews and stories and testimony, and deal with the obvious problems that they have, you still end up with something that's very powerful and very convincing. And that, getting back to the long-term implications, I think that what I'm hoping to achieve is that these accounts will at least be given an equal weight to the colonial versions. I'm not saying they are the correct version, but at least no one can, I hope, rely solely on the colonial account, that people will know there's another version out there, and then they can choose, make up their own mind as to what they believe. Mm. And the implications are certainly to, I think if the rest of Canada, the non-Indigenous part of Canada, has a greater understanding of what the First Nations understood that they agreed to, then it may influence their attitudes towards negotiating modern treaties or renegotiating old ones, that there is a real good reason to do so, and that there's a very good reason for First Nations to still be complaining, lo these many years later, because they seem to have a very good basis to do so, and that it's time for the rest of us to acknowledge that and to negotiate with them as equals. Part of what I'm doing, I think, is to help in the Idle No More movement, because a lot of that is to do with First Nations wanting their treaty rights to be implemented, but most Canadians don't know what those are. So that I'm hoping to help bring the First Nations point of view forward so that the Canadians will basically make good decisions based on that knowledge that they don't presently have. So I'm not trying to destabilize everything, and it's certainly not about threatening people's homes and their title to their land. It's really an acknowledgement that our old understanding is probably very imperfect, and that we need to take into account these other points of view and come up with something that works for both sides.
Hmm. I can see we're out of time. Unfortunately, it's gone by very quickly today. Thank you so much for coming in and talking about your research.
I'm always glad to do that. I intend to do it more.
And how long will you be, how long do you have left completing your PhD?
I'm hoping to have my draft done in, it's a bit of a movable target, but maybe June, and hope to defend in maybe September, October, something like that, and convocate in the spring of 2015 on the 50th anniversary of my first association with UVic.
Well, good luck and congratulations on getting this far. Thank you for listening to Beyond the Jargon. If you want to listen again, visit our website, cfuv.uvic.ca. The music you heard today is from Solar Mass Collective Volume 2, the song BOC by Kimchi Kitty.